Good evening. I want to talk to you tonight about improvement grants. First, a simple question. Who or what qualifies for one of these grants? The simple answer is everyone or everything. You may take it for granted that grants are granted for any improvement that falls within the meaning of the falling within the meaning section of the Improvement Grants Act. What constitutes an improvement? Broadly speaking, something that you can do or not do, or get someone else to do or not do, that will make it larger or tidier or cleaner or quieter. An improvement is anything that you do to anything or not do to anything, or a combination of these things or not these things, which, if you hadn't done it or hadn't done it, as the case may be, would have left something very much as it was in the first place, and that is, in need of improvement. How do you qualify for an improvement grant? Well, step one, you must have something worth improving. Do not be dismayed if you have nothing, as this in itself may qualify you for a grant with which to get something that will qualify you. If you have something that can be improved, get a professional person to look at it. He will then send in a report which states, I, a professional person, hereby confirm that I have, on this day, seen something. And I have every reason to suppose that any improvement grant granted to someone will result in an improvement to the something. Someone will then send someone to examine your something. When someone is satisfied that you are the somebody you say you are, and your something is what you say it is, and something could be done with your something, then someone will authorize your application and send you something so that you or somebody else can do something to your something. In this way, we hope to be able to do everything for somebody and something for everybody. thank you.
We present Lines from My Grandfather's Forehead, a sequential entertainment for radio, starring Ronnie Barker, also featuring Terence Brady and Pauline Yates, with Gordon Langford at the piano.
Just coming.
Yes.
All right, hang on a minute.
Oh, good. Evening, Cynthia.
Hello, darling. Now, look, we're having a little party downstairs. I don't know whether you knew.
Yes, I can hear it. Yes.
And I just popped out to ask you to be a poppet. Pop down.
No, I can't. Not at the moment.
Oh, come on, darling. Now, you promised. You promised to come to my next party. I do so want us to get together and to get to know each other.
Oh, yes, so do I. Yes, but,
But what? It's only downstairs. Do come down, darling.
Well, I've got some milk on.
Milk?
Yes. It's on. The milk is.
Well, turn it off.
Well, I'm timing it, you see, so I can't stop.
I'm timing it?
It's an experiment. I time the time it takes to boil, and this tells me how hot it is when it is boiling. And so I can work out how hot it was when it was halfway between cold and hot. It's to do with my work.
You're an accountant.
Yeah. Ah, well, that too, yes. But as part of my training, I have... I have to go to these night classes, you see, to study milk and other liquids in relation to their boiling points and consequently density. And then I add up all the results, and this helps me in my adding up and accounting, the accounting that I do.
Well, I've never known you go out at night. When are these night classes held?
In the mornings. That's why I'm having a bit of a boil up tonight, so as to be ready with all the data.
Oh, you're having me on, pulling my leg.
Oh, no. I wouldn't dream of having your... pulling the wool over your leg, over your head. It's very nice of you to ask me down for a glass of milk. But I'm measuring the temperature of the telly. I'll write to you. Must go now, otherwise I shall boil over.
Oh dear, Marianne will be so disappointed. I promised her I'd get you to come down.
Marianne. She at the party with you?
Yes.
Yes. Well, I'll just get out of these pyjamas and I'll be right down then.
But what about your milk?
Oh, to hell with that! You can drink cocoa any time.
Yes, I've got you so far. Then after Leeds, I suppose you take the M1 and come into London through Swiss Cottage?
No, not quite. After Rugby, you take the B12345 towards Bicester, but before you get there, you turn left at the Blue Cow in Langton.
I see.
This brings you onto a handy side road near Thorncester, which you turn off after the second level crossing.
Oh, and this brings you straight into London on a back road?
No, no, it brings you to a mud lane, where you abandon the car and walk half a mile till you see a sign saying Two Trees Farm. Now you go up to the farm and knock on the door.
And the farmer shows you a quick way to London?
No. The farmer's wife says any friend of Adrian, that's me, by the way, any friend of Adrian is a friend of mine, and takes you into the hall. Now, there'll be half a dozen scantily clad blondes in there. Now then, simply follow the farmer's wife up the stairs, keeping the banisters on your left, turn right onto the landing, and take the second door on the right.
I say, good Lord. And what happens next?
Well, from there on, it's a straight drive through to London.
An innocent maid came to London and lodged there in Sinful Earl's Court, where a villain one day tried to tempt her away with a small lemonade and a port. Drink this, pretty maiden, he whispered. But she, with a shake of her head, flung the glass to the ground, then to everyone round. As she checked his advances, she said,
Lips that touch liquor shall never touch mine, no, never, although you may sneer. Lips that have drunk of the juice of the vine, and the same goes for champagne or beer. I promised my aged old mother that drinks from strange men I decline. So don't beg my embrace with that froth on your face. Those lips, sir, shall never touch mine.
Come, come, pretty maid, one won't hurt you.
But, sir, I refuse all the same. That stain on your waistcoat is not picturesque. It's just gin and the mark of your shame.
Curses.
There's many a poor girl in London sleeps on the embankment today. She's society's loss, and it's simply because those girls were unable to say. Lips that touch liquor shall never touch mine. Lips that touch liquor I shun. To be kissed through Scotch mist is a treat I decline. Unhand me, begone, sir, have done. It's little use rolling your eyeballs. I see through your wicked design. And although an old-fashioned might make you impassioned, those lips, sir, shall never touch mine.
He tried her with brandy balls, wine gums. He leered and he twirled his moustache. Till at last, with a lisp, she accepted a crisp, a small lemonade and a dash. But just as she raised the glass mouthwards, a voice from the crowd shouted, Stop!
'Tis your own Sailor Jack. Just come off Miss Mac. You are saved from that poisonous pop. Lips that touch liquor shall never touch us. My Nell can't be bought with your gold. Wine is a mocker, strong drink is a curse. It stings like the adder, I'm told. And though she's exposed to temptation, while I am away on the brine, it would kill her old mum if she knocked back that rum. And those lips, Nell, would never touch mine.
Forgive me, dear Jack, I was tempted.
Of course, dearest Nell, you're forgive.
Ah, curse it, I'm foiled. There's another plan spoiled by a sweet and a tender young love.
The moral of this little story is simple and plain, I should say. If you accept liquor, then drink it down quicker, or someone might take it away.
Oh, yes, sir, yes, indeed. Yes, during my lifetime, I've met many famous people. I met Sir Winston Churchill more than once.
I remember that first occasion as though it were yesterday. I'd been to a football match in Shotley. 1923, I think. It may have been 33. It doesn't matter. The point was that looking downwards and slightly to my left in the more expensive seats, I saw a very familiar back. It was, as I was later to discover, and as I was almost certain even then, the back of Sir Winston Churchill, or Mr. Churchill, as he was then. 1923 it was, yes. Not 15 years later, I again encountered Mr. Churchill, or Sir Winston Churchill, as he was later to become. I was standing among a group of people at Oxford Circus in London, when a large chauffeur-driven limousine pulled up alongside me. I would not have noticed the occupant, had it not been for the fact that as the vehicle drew to a halt, held up by the traffic ahead, a hand holding a large and aromatic cigar appeared in the near side rear window. I looked in at the window and saw that it was indeed Sir Winston Churchill, or Mr. Churchill, as he still was at that particular moment in history. I longed to remind him of that football match so long ago, but all I could muster was a remark, "What a terrible traffic jam, sir!" The quizzical gaze, beloved of millions, yet feared by dictators the world over, was turned on me, and I waited breathlessly as his mouth began to open. Unfortunately, at that moment, the traffic ahead moved on, and so naturally did Mr. Churchill's limousine, or Sir Winston Churchill's limousine, as it was later to become. The last occasion was just after the general election at the end of the last war. Unfortunately, I'd been ill in bed for a few days, and I'd not heard the result of the election, my wireless said, having gone on the blink, as we used to say in those days. Now, on my way to the High Street to purchase a newspaper, I met the great man once more. Again he was in a limousine, and again his limousine was stationary, this time held up by traffic lights. Unhesitatingly, for by now I felt like an old friend, such was the personal magnetism of that architect of victory, unhesitatingly, I tapped on his window. With a slight frown, he lowered it from inside and looked out at me inquiringly. Although, as I say, I had not actually heard the result of the general election, I had no doubt in my own mind just how a grateful nation had voted. "Meet one of the people," I cried. "Meet one of the people who have helped, albeit humbly, to put you in the position you find yourself in today, sir." I'm sure you can imagine how my heart swelled with pride as the great man thrust his gloved hand out of the window and directed at me, under my very nose, in fact, the gesture that has become justly and famously identified with him throughout the world.
Though life on the whole around the North Pole has certainly got its faults, there's a little igloo where we can both do the Aurora Borealis waltz. In warm woolly drawers, two roars of applause, we'll indulge in Icelandic schmaltz. Like Eskimos do, we'll rub noses to the Aurora Borealis waltz. With a tiny oil lamp to keep out the damp, the merriment never halts. So say you'll be mine at wick trimming time in the Aurora Borealis waltz.
Can you manage your right under the sink? Do you need a torch?
Oh, I can see it. The washer's split.
Gotta put a new one on.
Yeah, I might as well, yeah. Let's have an adjustable spanner there. Top. Oh, and a bucket. That's it.
What size washer?
Well, nothing like we've got. You better cut one out. Make it, let's see, one minute. 2 1/4 inside, 3 1/2 outside.
The lady said if we chipped her paint, she'd have a few words with the governor.
Ah, words. How long a time lies in one little word. Shakespeare, that is. Richard II. BBC Two last night.
She said she'd have a few words with him.
One would be enough. if only she knew it.
What one's that?
Now you're asking, ain't you? What is the word?
That's what I just said.
You know, back in ancient times, even before that, there was a mighty warrior king once.
What, Richard II?
No, before him. Years and years. You know, over towards Phoenicia, China, over that way it was. Before they invented iron, even. Hey, give us that rag, will you?
Yeah.
Oh, dear, this woman's one of them, you know. Only cleans what shows. Like a sewer under here, it is.
What about that warrior king?
Oh, well, he beat hell out of everyone, he did. Then he sent for his professors and sent them all around the world, pinching all the books they could find.
How could they have books?
No, they didn't have proper books, you know. Parchment, scrolls, clay tablets, you know, that sort of stuff.
Oh, yeah.
He had to build a whole city to store them in. Anyhow, the king made his professors read the lot, and then he told them to boil it down to something smaller. Where's that washer?
Here.
Top.
I bet that took some doing.
Oh, no, they did it all right. Yeah. They boiled it all down to 100 books. Well, what they call books, you know.
All the knowledge in the world.
Yeah, and them old boys knew more than we do now. Yeah, 100 books. That's no good, says the king. No, that's no good. You can do better than that.
Sounds like our governor.
Yeah. So they have another go, and they get it all into 10 books.
And still he wasn't satisfied.
Right, just like the governor. Right, try the cold tap, will you, ain't it?
Okay, here you got him.
Yeah, that's all right, yeah. Right, good. You can start backing up now, then.
Right.
Yeah, he got it all down to 10 books, you see. But the king, you know, he just cut off some of their heads to show he meant business.
The governor's not that bad.
No, they got it down to 10 pages, then a one page, then a one sentence. Of course, by this time, there was only one professor left.
What about the others?
Well, all had their heads chopped off, hadn't they? No, it's no good, says the king. That's no good to me. All I want is one word. Yeah, that's what he wanted. All the knowledge in the world, all the power, all in one word. So this old professor went off, shut himself away for 8 years, and boiled it down to one word.
God.
Yeah. Then at the end of the 8 years, he come out of his study, waving his little bit of paper with it on, and he dropped dead with mental exhaustion.
But he'd done it.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Have you got all the gear of it?
Yeah, all packed up.
Right. Oh, yeah. Yeah. This bloke, he got it all down to one single word.
Well, what was it?
I don't know. No one could read his writing.
Oh, if you don't stop it this minute, I'll thump you one.
Yes, the unmistakable voice of the Prince of Laughter himself, Ernie Bloomgage, in a short excerpt there from the Lovable Comics' latest film, Who Do You Think You're Talking To, Big Boy? Because if you don't stop it this minute, I'll thump you one. Or, as they're calling it in Water Street these days, WDYTYTTBBBIYDSITMITYO for short. Or is it long? Anyway, whatever you call it, Ernie's newest laughter jerker, well, you can say tearjerker, so why not laughter jerker, is all set to have them rolling in the proverbial aisles. And that, according to Ernie Bloomgage's friend and business manager, the Earl of Bilgally, means the British Isles.
Oh, yes, I'm sure we're on to a winner, all right.
Bigger than Snap?
Snap?
Stop nibbling Olive's pudding.
Oh, you mean Snot. Oh, yes, much bigger.
It's a bigger title, for one thing.
What?
It's a bigger title, for one thing.
Oh, yes. Yes.
The irrepressible Earl of Bilgally, Ernie Bloomgage's blue-blooded pal. When I asked him if comedy-making was all fun and games, he had this to say.
Oh, no. No.
Straight from the horse's mouth. Ernie Bloomgage, in fact, veteran of 23 British comedies, really works at getting his laughs. And we'll be looking at Ernie's career as we present Radio Style, a film portrait of The Laughter Maker. better way to etch in the first fine brushstrokes of our portrait than with a few well-chosen words from the jokesmith himself.
Of course, what I always say is comedy is a very serious business.
Really? Really? Serious?
Deadly serious, Michael. I mean, you know, you have to take it serious or it doesn't work, you know?
Well, can you give me, for instance... For instance, you know, give me a for instance.
Oh, yeah, well... like in my latest movie, who do you think you're talking to, Big Boy? Because if you don't stop it this minute, I'll thump you one.
What a mouthful, Ernie.
Oh, yeah, but we call it WDYT... No. B. No. Wait a minute. WTYT...
WDT. Well, anyway, like I said, it's quite a mouthful.
Yeah, but it's shorter, you see, if you just...
Yeah, use the initials, yes.
Yeah.
But to come back to that fascinating point you made a moment ago, how did you put it? Something about comedy being...
Comedy is a very serious business.
Serious?
Oh, yes, it is. Deadly serious. I mean, all your greats were serious about comedy, weren't they? Chaplin, Keaton, Lloyd, Tarbuck.
Arbuckle, you mean? Arbuckle?
That's a fella, yeah. Yeah, comes from Liverpool. Yeah. Yeah, up all night, I am thinking him up the gags, you know.
Yes. Dangerous too, sometimes.
Oh, yes. Dangerous. Yeah, like we was earlier talking. Rachel.
Rachel, yes. Who doesn't? Who doesn't?
Yeah. When she falls over the chair, you mean, in the penthouse flat?
Oh, yes. Oh, I remember that, yeah. Yeah. And she breaks her neck.
That's the one, yeah. Took me all night to think that one up. Yeah. Falling over the churner.
Tell me, did he make you laugh at the time?
No, not a titter. Not even when we shot it.
Not a titter from Ernie, but the night we went to the sneak preview, the audience was far from titterless. Here's the scene Ernie and I were talking about, and about to loop the loop over that chair, the luscious Rachel herself.
My picture? You want to take my picture, Ernie?
That's right, ducks. Lean back a bit more.
You mean like this?
A bit more, love.
Right over. Like this. I think I've broken my neck.
And the superbly endowed Rachel goes arm over elbow. And the audience never even guessed that plucky little Rachel really had broken her neck. What a trooper. And talking of troopers, here's Ernie Bloomgain as Trooper McGill in a Can You Spot the Star clip from Trooper McGill of the Foreign Legion, circa 1971.
Oh, Ernie, for God's sake, stop swinging your wee rifle.
Why? What's the matter, Joe?
Oh, Ernie, that bayonet is just a wee bit dangerous. Oh, oh!
And another bonny Scotsman bites the foreign heather. Ernie Bloomgage is Trooper McGill, of course. But did you recognise his long-suffering one-up-a-killed oppo? Yes, you've got it. It was the late, great Taffy McBraggart, who you'll remember was so tragically killed during the shooting, oops, no pun intended, at the shooting of that film. Ernie Bloomgage is a three-headed Medusa for all seasons, a triumvirate of talented mischief, being director, writer, and star. Makes your head spin, doesn't it? But not Ernie's, for he eats, sleeps, and lives his chosen profession of laughter maker. So much so that his hobby is, yes, you've guessed it, making film comedies home movie style. Any weekend you'll find him in the grounds of his lovely converted Surrey bordello, sporting his movie camera and peering anxiously up at those unpredictable clouds. And when Ernie's in filmmaking mood, everyone has to join in. Except for 83-year-old Jim Vole, Ernie Bloomgage's 85-year-old gardener, who is something of a character.
Oh, yeah, always remember the place he is making pictures. Yes. Look, see over yonder,
yes,
at the back of the house. Mm-hmm. See that top floor window?
Yeah.
Well, he had Rosie and George up there. That's a cooking postman they was, George being local like. Go on, says Mr. Bloomgage, it's going to be a right old laugh, he says. And he's got poor old Rosie and George hanging for dear life by their fingernails at that top window.
But he surely took safety precautions, didn't he?
Oh, yeah. Don't worry about falling, he says. Because his three sets of matches on the path underneath the window. Oh,
mattresses, yes.
Yeah, what he didn't say was they was under a different window. Oh, dear. Oh, well, he says to me, he's always taking us off in the kitchen garden. Oh, well, Vaughan, he says. Oh, you reckon that's show business.
How typical of the man that remark is. No matter how rough the going gets, Ernie Blumgage is up in the saddle and firing on all cylinders again before you can say Georgie Best. But let's meet the person closest to him, personally and professionally. Mrs. Blumgage, herself a star in the latest Blumgage film.
How did Ernie think up that marvellously funny gag for you in Who Do You Think You're Talking To?
I don't know, really. It's a sequence in Rotten Row, you mean?
Yes.
Well, it seemed to come to him on the spur of the moment. I had to ride past, all dignified, you know. Mm. And there was this overhanging branch sort of hanging over.
Yes.
And Ernie, just like that, right off the top of his head, almost as if it just popped into his mind from nowhere, Ernie said, "Look, love," he said, "how about when you ride under that branch, we sort of like cheat it.
Yeah.
So it looks as if you've hit your bonce and come a right old cropper."
This is a tremendous effect, of course. Genuine slapstick.
Oh, it was.
Yeah.
Nurse, could you plump up these pillows a bit, please?
A somewhat rattled Ina Blumgage, and we all wish her a speedy recovery there in the intensive care unit. Well, we've shown you just a few of the smiling faces of Ernie Blumgage's multifaceted personality. Ernie is at present on location in the Swiss Alps making his very latest film, Don't Take Any Wooden Cuckoo Clocks, due for release next year. This week he's shooting the already highly publicised scene in which Bobby Beamish has to fall off a precipice. The drop to the mountain stream below is several thousand feet, but the Blumgage unit has erected a safety net a mere 10 feet below. No worry about safety there. So what better way to end this light-hearted portrait than by dropping in on the great man at work? And I'll see you next week.
Right then, Bobby. Ready for a take?
Yeah, yes, I think so.
Right, everyone, shoot in this time.
Just a minute, Ernie.
Yes, love?
Is the safety net in position?
Yeah, of course it is, Bobby.
There's no chairs to trip over, is there?
Bobby, on a mountain top.
Well, all right then. No guns or bayonets.
No,
or...
Bobby, look, you've got to trust me.
Oh, all right then.
Right, everyone, settle down, please. Shooting this time.
Sure about the safety net, Ernie?
Yes, absolutely sure, Bobby.
Oh,
now,
yeah.
On your mark, Rebecca's just pushed you, right?
Yeah.
And action.
Oh, Rebecca, you shouldn't have done that.
Cue explosion.
Yeah, what explosion?
No traffic light to halt his flight. No signs to tell him nay. No traffic jam to block his path as home he wends his way. As free as air, the seagull glides. He'll swoop down where he may, to where another seagull sits, and kick him out the way.
You've been listening to Lines from My Grandfather's Forehead, starring Ronnie Barker, with Terence Brady, Pauline Yates, and Gordon Langford at the piano. The lines were written by Tony Bilbo and Mike Fentiman, David Climie and Gordon Langford, John Graham, Miles Kington, Roy Lomax, Miles Rudge and Max Harris, and Peter Spence. The programme was produced by John Fawcett Wilson.